Welcome to the Narrator's Minicast. This is a bite-sized podcast with just a few stories that I will do every month, a few weeks after the main narrators. The first story I recorded here at my house, this is a local comedian named Ben Roy, who's an amazing comedian. Check him out if you get the chance, and he shares a story. It's not particularly funny, but it is a great story. This is Ben Roy.
I grew up in Maine in it was an area that I grew up in, and everybody had known me from that. And I think that I was kind of picked on for being real sensitive, and you know, I tell people I worry about you, and people be like, fag, you know, like that kind of thing. It was just a very like hick type environment, and I love a lot of the people. You know, as they've grown, they've become more sensitive themselves, but there was definitely a bravado about things. And when I was about 19, a girlfriend and I that I had at the time broke up with me. And, you know, looking back, it's just kid stuff. But she really, like, kind of messed up my life at that particular time. I mean, I don't harbor any ill will. She's a good person. It's, you know. But, you know, I would let her use my car all the time. And she didn't work. She was a couple of years younger. She was almost 18, and she had moved out of her house. She had kind of a difficult living situation at the time. And while I was at work, she would leave. I would let her use my car that I had just bought while I was at work. And she would leave and be gone. And one night she didn't show up to pick me up. And I couldn't get a hold of her. She just didn't show up. And I got a call from her mom that she had been in a car accident. Don't worry. She's been in a car accident. But she's fine. But your car is totaled. And I was like, more concerned about her. Ended up being picked up. Went out to where the accident was. Saw the car. Bent the frame and everything. I mean, it was totaled. Brand new car that I bought. But it was way out in the middle of nowhere. That's the part I couldn't figure out. We lived at the time in Augusta, in the capital, and that was nowhere near the area that she got in the accident. It was actually across a river. She would have had to have crossed a bridge. She said that she got lost going back to our apartment. She grew up in this area. She didn't get lost. So over time, after, you know, the fear that, you know, or the worry that she was okay subsided, more came up like, what the hell were you doing out there? And it ended up coming out that she had been going out there to see her ex-boyfriend. And while I was at work, they would play Ozzy and Harriet in the car and drive around. He would drive, and they would just go all around. You know, sometimes they went down, like, you know, to Portland, which is about 40 miles, has all the malls and stuff. And they just basically, and so she was leaving hurried, trying to come pick her real boyfriend up, the person she lived with, and got in a wreck because she didn't know the road all that well. And so we ended up breaking up, and immediately went from a situation where I had everything. I felt like I had a family at home. Like, we were starting to form like this like type of living situation. And at that age, that's, you know, I was like, oh, this is awesome. I got a girlfriend and an apartment. And went to all of my buddies that I skated with moving in. It was a one-bedroom apartment. There were five of us living there. I really started drinking pretty heavily. At the time, I decided then that I didn't really want to live anymore. So I thought, well, I'm just maybe as best if I wasn't alive any longer. You know, and I started having a lot of thoughts about suicide, killing myself. I even went so far as to, I was taking Klonopins for anxiety. I put a whole bunch of them in my mouth and ended up having a tearful conversation with a family member and deciding that I wouldn't do it then. And it was just a miserable time. Hated my job. Wasn't playing in a band anymore. My band had fell apart. And so it was just a real, but I always put a face on like I was happy, unless I was really drunk. And then one time, and I didn't know what to do, and I had this job I hated, and so I was on my way to work, and I stopped into this sandwich shop that I always used to stop into. And the whole time I'm stressed and I'm like, I want to get out of this place. I don't have any money. I have like $100 to my name. I want to move out to Colorado where my friends were and they want to start a band, but I can't do it. And I was heading to work and I stopped by the sandwich shop and this guy who was always there was obnoxious. But I'd always be nice about it. I'm just that type of person. I would just, you know, humor his ridiculous stories and he would just yammer on to everybody in there. And it was just, you know, what I didn't want to hear at that point. And I walked in, but I'm plastering on a smile and whatever and just kind of hanging out. And he's like, hey, he saw me standing there and I'm at the lowest point I've been at. And he said, hey, do you know how African pygmies catch monkeys? And I was like, oh, Jesus, shut the fuck up. Like, I don't want to listen to you fucking talk right now. But I was just like, no, yeah, what? And he's like, what they do is they take a coconut, right? And then they drill into one side of it a hole and they tie a rope so there's a knot and you can't get the coconut. And they tie that other end of the rope around a tree. And then they drill into the other side of it and they put peanut butter on the inside of it. And so when a monkey comes along, he can fit his hand into the hole and he'll grab the peanut butter. But when he makes a fist around the peanut butter, he can't pull his hand out. It's impossible. So he just sits there and yanks. And he's holding on to this peanut butter. And the pygmies will run up and they'll just club him. And he stopped. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. And I am about at vomiting with disgust with my life and just miserable. And he said, you know what the moral of the story is? And I was like, no, not really paying attention. And he's like, look at me. And I was kind of taken back by that. So I looked at him and he goes, just let go. And I don't know what it was at that time, but I don't know if I needed to hear that or whatever. But I burst into tears. Right standing there, I started crying, waiting for this fucking sandwich, and I'm sitting here sobbing. Thank God there wasn't anybody else in there at the time. He did not act like this was a strange reaction in any manner. He wasn't like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, are you all right? It's just a stupid story. He just sat there, and I don't know if I had been wearing it. I'm not sure if I'd been just displaying it on my face. I thought I was doing a good bit of hiding it. But I sat there and cried for a minute and I grabbed my sandwich and I left. And then probably I would think about 3 or 4 weeks later, I quit my job and I drove out to Colorado with $80. And I've kind of been here ever since.
The next story was actually part of the regular narrator's show on the theme of love. And I really wanted it on the last podcast, but I was already going over time, so I wanted to share here. This is Mary Robertson. She's a student of sociology, and she's sharing her, I suppose, unlikely love story. This is Mary Robertson.
So I have a lot of anxiety about telling this love story, because it implicates me and an old friend in a highly stigmatized relationship. I'm anxious not only about sharing it with a bunch of strangers, but also with some of my friends and my lover who are here tonight, and the thought of it being podcast is just a little bit less than terrifying. And already I've made a bigger deal of it than it was or should be. That said, I'm going to tell this story because I'm tired of all the shame and fear we have about intimacy, especially intimacy that doesn't conform to normative ideas about heterosexual, monogamous, adult, procreative, intimate relationships. I'm going to tell it because I believe in love. The summer I turned 12, my family moved into a newly built condominium. I lucked out and got the best room in the house. It was huge with vaulted ceilings and 3 big windows looking out over the courtyard where the 20 or so condos in the complex all faced. I could monitor the comings and goings of all my neighbors while singing along to NXS and Depeche Mode on my turntable. I'm not exactly sure when Jake and Debbie moved in, but it couldn't have been long after we did. In my 12-year-old eyes, they were an intriguing couple, Jake was of 23, and Debbie was quite a bit older than him. It's hard to say now, but she was maybe 30 or so, which, boy, you know, when you were 12, 30 was like ancient. And now I think, anyways. Debbie had a 6-year-old son by another man, and Jake was her smoking hot young boyfriend. Debbie smoked cigarettes on the stoop and had long painted fingernails and permed hair. Jake painted houses for a living, drove a Ford pickup truck, and wore a leather motorcycle jacket. Due to the communal nature of the courtyard, the neighbors, especially those of us who either were kids or had kids, got to know each other pretty quickly. I'm not exactly sure either when I fell in love with Jake. It's hard to remember after all these years just when the switch flipped. Some might even argue that what I was feeling never was love, that it couldn't have been anything more than a young girl's crush. But it was so much more than that. It may still have been a crush when I started watching for Jake to come and go from my perfect vantage point high up in my bedroom every day, or when I would find an excuse to go outside at the exact moment that he was coming or going. It may still have been a crush when we swapped cassette tapes, my copies of old Generation X records in exchange for his Dead Kennedys' Fresh Fruit for Rotten Vegetables. But it wasn't a crush when we first kissed. When I could finally tell him to his face how I felt about him and he, me, it was love. I thought so then, and I still think so now. But I'm jumping ahead, so let's back up. I didn't kiss Jake when I was 12. For the first few years I knew him, we were just friends. But we were really good friends, buddies, if you will. There is no question that I was unhealthily obsessed with him during this period. I wanted to like everything he liked. I fantasized about being his girlfriend. I imagined him playing male lead to my female star in movies. Remember that scene in Legend when Lily throws her ring into the lake and Jack dives in after it, and it's like the absolute most romantic thing a teenage girl has ever seen? And they're in this beautiful forest, and cotton is flying through the air, and she's so lovely, and he's so handsome. So I was watching that at Jake and Debbie's house one night, and I said, God, I wish someone would do that for me. And this dude, who I was convinced could never have a single thought in his head about me, other than that I was cute, but that I was the cute but somewhat annoying tomboy who lived down the way, said I would. He may not have meant anything at all, other than to say that he thought I was special and worth a dive to the bottom of a fairy tale lake. But to me, it was the attention I'd been craving. I'm not sure I was even in love with him then. I wasn't a stupid girl. I was an obsessed girl, sure, but I knew I was expending a whole lot of time and energy pining for a man 11 years my elder who dated an adult woman who had boobs and with whom surely he was in love, and that what I was doing in the privacy of my own head was a fantasy. And it was safe. He wasn't a creep. He didn't touch me or try to touch me. He didn't talk about sex or inappropriate things. He didn't try to date me or get me drunk or any of the things you hear about inappropriate relationships between innocent girls and lecherous men. We were just friends. I'll never forget sitting in the living room with Debbie after she and Jake had one of their numerous breakups. Jake had moved out in the night, much to my absolute chagrin, and there I was sitting on the couch with his sniffling, teary, 30-year-old girlfriend, pretending to agree with her that Jake was an asshole. Out of nowhere, she says, what Jake really wants is a buddy, like you, but he can't fuck you, so that's what I'm for. I'm not sure what I said in response to that, but you can be sure that I was equally appalled and thrilled, because while on the one hand, I couldn't believe she had said that to me, on the other, it meant that he liked me, he really liked me. Never mind that Debbie probably said that to me out of bitterness and anger at her immature jag-off of a boyfriend, not because she really thought Jake wished she could be with me. But I ran with it anyway. That wasn't the first or the last time Jake moved out on Debbie, and eventually they moved out of the condo complex altogether, as did we. But I continued to think too much about him. I couldn't help it that everything reminded me of him, from Billy Idol to Ford pickup trucks to painter pants. I remember there was an auto shop near my house, Jake's Automotive, which was just one more obstacle standing in the way of me getting over it. But of course, we don't really want to get over it so quickly, do we? Deep longing, love, desire. We want to muck around in it, let it crawl under our skin, wrench our hearts, draw tears from our eyes. We love it because it hurts. And time went by. Although I certainly had crushes on boys my own age, they never seemed to like me back. I wasn't pretty enough or silly enough or easy enough, I guess. I was smart, and I was a tomboy, and I wanted to be intellectually challenged and inspired. And the trouble with the boys I knew is that they just seemed to want me to admire them and not think too much or say too much. Jake thought I was interesting and admired me, and he thought my short haircut was punk rock and cool, where boys my age probably thought it was too butch. And so I loved him. Was I 15 or 16 the first time we made out? Funny, I can't remember what was once such a momentous experience. We'd kept in touch on and off by phone, and I talked him into meeting me at a cemetery near my best friend Kaylee's house. In the first version of this story, I claimed to not remember who had initiated it, but it was definitely me. It was one of those moments that you look back on now and realize your best friend deserves a medal, not only for sharing in your excitement of being in love and for keeping your secret, but also for agreeing to be your cover, which meant going to the cemetery and walking around bored outside while you make out with some creepy old dude in the front seat of his pickup truck. And here's where my story takes a turn for the boring. Jake and I never had sex. We never even had oral sex. But we were pretty intimate with each other on a few occasions over the next handful of years. It was never regular. He was never my boyfriend. I finally fell in love with someone else and got over him for the most part. I lost my virginity to a lovely young man at the ripe old age of 17. He was totally age appropriate at 20. The last time I hung out with Jake, I was 19 or 20 and living on my own downtown. I went bar hopping with he and his friend Jay. I rode between the two of them on Jay's crotch rocket down Lodo alleys from City Spirit to Calvin's to the Wing Coop. It was a thrill, and I loved being with Jake as a newly minted adult with a fake ID. We drank and played pool and did cocaine and made out on my bed, and we still never had sex. I'm not sure why. Well, probably it was the cocaine, which is another one reason why cocaine, one of the many reasons why cocaine is stupid. Maybe one of the most important reasons that it's stupid. But maybe, like all of the times before, we didn't have sex because he was ashamed to. I would have had sex, that is. I would have in the front seat of his truck all those years before. In fact, Jake could have done any number of things to me had he wanted to. I trusted him. I was in love with him. He was the center of my universe. But he wasn't a predator, a rapist, a child molester, and I wasn't just lucky. He was simply a young man who met a very young girl whom he loved. I remember being so disappointed during those earlier years when he wouldn't call me back or blow me off for what felt like ages, but I never considered for a second what a mind fuck it must have been for him. Certainly he knew that as far as society was concerned, as far as my mom was concerned, as far as his mom was concerned for that matter, but most importantly, as far as the law was concerned, it wasn't right. It never crossed my mind he could have been in a lot of trouble for what we did. Had it happened in today's climate, he might have spent his life labeled a sex offender. Do you understand what that means for people? Most sex offenders aren't people who molest little kids and are a danger to society. They're people who crossed some invisible line determined by society's moral gatekeepers who spend the rest of their lives labeled. They can't live in certain places and are under constant state surveillance. Believe me, I'm not suffering from false consciousness here. Jake never hurt me any more than any other person who broke my heart. Nor am I defending those who sexually exploit or abuse young people. But I'm deeply bothered by the shame and guilt I have about this relationship that I feel was foundational in my development as a sexual being. And without a doubt, had Jake sexually assaulted me after I talked him into meeting me in that cemetery that day, how difficult would it have been for me to tell my parents or the police? How would I have been able to tell the difference between what I had asked for and what I got? And I understand that this is exactly the reason some people think we need to regulate sexuality, why we need things like age of consent laws, to protect naive little girls from predatory men. But I'm here to argue that I think that kind of regulation and those laws fail to accomplish that. We create laws that decide for youth, in other words, girls and gay boys, when they can and can't consent to a sexual relationship, perpetuating a culture where patriarchal authority still knows best. We enable a fantasy that at the beginning of one's 18th year, poof, they're suddenly endowed with the capability to make adult decisions. It's confusing and unreasonable. When it comes to my story, I was probably wise beyond my years, and Jake, a little bit immature for his. In the name of love, I would like to suggest a more reasonable approach that involves trusting young people, girls and boys alike, who may not be adults, but are certainly not children, with the decisions about when and with whom they are going to have sex, and rather than raise them in a culture of fear and shame, give them the tools they need to make decisions that keep them safe.
The third and final story is from Isaac Fitzgerald. Isaac was touring across the country with Kyle Kinane, documenting his comedy tour, and he stayed at my house, and I managed to pry a few stories out of him. Isaac helps run a website called therumpus.net, which is a really cool website. I definitely recommend checking it out. It has really cool articles, a great advice column, and some really, really great independent comic strips. And that's therumpus.net. I remembered it easily because Isaac had it tattooed on his arm. In this story, Isaac tells about meeting a childhood friend in a faraway place. This is Isaac Fitzgerald.
This is about how I was given a sword by the King of Bhutan. When I was growing up, I was a bit of a screw-up. Should come as no surprise. And I was lucky enough, I got a full scholarship to a boarding school. Kind of not in my town, but close enough. So I got this full scholarship. I was 14 years old. I moved out of my folks' place and got to live on the campus. It was fantastic. By sophomore year, you know, I remember thinking, because I was getting into trouble in middle school, and when I got this scholarship to boarding school, I was like, all right, I'm cleaning up. No more drinking, no more pot, no more drugs. It's boarding school. Yeah, like, gonna take everything really serious. It's gonna turn my life around. And then, of course, by, like, you know, 2 months in freshman year, I'm like, oh, wait, no, the pot's better, the drinking's more fun. Rich people. Hooray. So by sophomore year, you had to take a sport. Basically, they're trying to make sure your time is as filled as possible because they don't know what to do with you, you know, right? It's like 400 kids and 40 adults trying to keep everything in line. So I signed up for JV2 basketball, not JV, definitely not varsity, JV2. At one point, we played a middle school, and I think they beat us. So... the reason for this, I like to say, is that because practice was only an hour long, whereas most practices were like 2.5, so that gave me time to like go smoke cigarettes or go, you know, screw around. Really, also, I'm shit at basketball. That should come as no surprise. I am neither tall nor graceful. So it's me, and I still have the picture of the team photo. It's just amazing because I was the only. It was just me and every single ESL kid in the school. It was just me and a bunch of kids from Asia. It's a bunch of Asian kids. And I'm like right in the middle, only white dude. That's because Christian Academy has a fantastic, I give them a little plug, they have a fantastic ESL program. People come from all around the world. They send their kids. One of those kids happened, he first, of course, went to like Exeter, Andover, one of those really good ones. But one of those kids' name was Jigme Wangchuk. And Jigme and I became friends. He was on the team. And we would go for runs after practice. And we would just go on these runs. And then we'd ditch into the woods. And we'd just like sit around, smoke cigarettes, and talk. And we quickly built a friendship. And one time he's like, Isaac, I have to tell you a secret. I was like, okay, Jigme. He's like, I'm the crown prince of Bhutan. And I said, Jigme, I have to tell you a secret. Everybody fucking knows that shit. It's very common knowledge. But I liked that he thought it. I appreciated that he thought it was a secret. But, you know, he did get a little special treatment, as he should. He is the only person on campus that is going to run a country. But, so our friendship continued to grow. I think he was a year, maybe 2 years older than me. So he graduates, and he comes to my dorm room. I remember this very vividly. And he sits down. And he's like, listen, I'm going to graduate. I'm going to school in Boston, but I don't know if we'll see each other. It's very important to me. He's like, we've talked about it quite a bit. I would love for you to come and visit my country. That would mean a lot to me. And I was like, Jigme, that's incredibly gracious. We'll definitely do it. You know, we're exchanging info. And me being the not so smart kid from Massachusetts, I'm kind of like, I'll meet other kings. Like, you know, like instead of like really getting on that and like staying in contact with them, months turn into a year or two. At one point I use the number that he has and I call overseas and I'm like, hey, is Jigme there? And the woman, I finally, like after a few women, somebody finally speaks English, gets on the phone and is just like, what do you mean? I'm like, Jigme Wangchuck, he's the prince. And she's just like, no offense, sir, but there are a lot of Jigmes here. And if you mean the crown prince, like that's, you can't just dial up. So basically I realized I was talking probably to the Bhutanese like operator board. I didn't know where Bhutan was. I was very ignorant. I didn't realize that it's a very small country. It's like 600,000 people. Southeast Asia, et cetera, et cetera. So long story short, we obviously grow very, very far apart. You know, fond memories, but I'm just like, that ship has passed. When I am 2008, so when I am 25 maybe or 26, I was working in a bar. I wasn't doing much. I had a girlfriend at the time who encouraged me. She was like, listen, you've never really spent a lot of time overseas. You know, you never did a study abroad program in college. You know, it's going to be very quick for you to just like wake up and all of a sudden you're going to be working in this bar and you're 40. Why don't you just save up a little money and go do something interesting? And she was like, I taught English on the Thai-Burma border. Would you be interested in that? And I was like, I don't want to teach. She's like, well, there's this pretty badass group called the Free Burma Rangers who smuggle medical supplies into Burma. And I'm like, that crazy shit. I want to know that. And that's kind of a different story and a more somber tale. But the Free Burma Rangers do some amazing work. There's lots of issues in Burma, etc. But I do that for 3 months. And it's like the most amazing, fulfilling thing I've ever done with my life. And it was absolutely wonderful. I was smuggling medical supplies into Burma. If I'd been smuggling drugs out, I probably would have been making a lot more money. But again, with the nativity kind of works both ways. So now I'm like, oh, I'm in Southeast Asia. It's like Bhutan's kind of around here. And so I'm like, I should just see if I just give it the old college try. So I start emailing and trying to get in touch with Jigme any way possible. And first off, the Bhutanese government, at least at the time, is on Gmail. That is the official email accounts of anybody you're trying to get in touch with. And so, but I do, I make traction. I talk to this person puts me in touch with this person, et cetera, et cetera. And so all of a sudden, I get an email that says, you need to copy your passport right now and send it to us. You reply this email with a PDF of your passport, and then you need to be in Bangkok tomorrow for a plane that flies out. It's one of the only planes that it's going to stop in India, and then it's going to go to Bhutan. They do like two flights a day or something. Guest of the government. And that's what's, I mean, guest of the government. I'm not even a bartender. I wash dishes in a bar, and I was like, I'm fucking guest of the government of Bhutan. It's fucking amazing. But again, I have to be in Bangkok the next day. I'm probably like half a day's drive. Really almost no clothes. I just drive a 125cc motorcycle, or I'm sorry, scooter, and ditch it in the parking lot, get on the plane, get out there, don't look anything up. And this leads to many faux pas while I'm there. Wow. A very funny one was, I was just like, oh, this country is Buddhist, right? And like, that's the first thing I said to the guy that picked me up from the plane. He's just like, oh, fucking ugly American. And then another one was, we're all eating, and they're like, oh, you should try the yak stomach. And what I said was, oh, well, you only live once, right? And in a culture that believes in reincarnation, that did not go over very well. But I ate a shit ton of yak stomach. I made up for it, and they really liked that. They told me that I must have been Bhutanese in a previous life. Therefore, I also dig it to be like, hey, we don't think you only live once. But that's all later. What really, the fun moment for me is they teach me how to bow. They do all this stuff. And then finally they get me to Jigme. And I do this, you know, I do the bow that they taught me. And he immediately just grabs me. He's 28 at this point, or 29 years old. Runs a country. Like, I can't even imagine that. And he gives me this huge hug. And like, you can kind of tell, you know, when somebody like, doesn't get touched enough almost, like, you know, like his friends can't speak to him unless spoken to. And so like, it's just this amazing, amazing moment. And I'm hugging him and I'm just like holding him. And he steps back and says, one, first I heard it's your birthday, which was awesome, and I'm guessing it was on my passport, but he's right. So he was like, I want to give you this, and it was a sword, which I was very excited about, and the guy who had driven me over, who I'd asked, this is Buddhist country, right, saw my eyes light up and immediately leaned in and whispered, this doesn't make you a knight. This doesn't make you a knight. So that, for like 0.2 seconds, I thought I was a knight of Bhutan. I am not, but I did get a sweet sword. And then he just grabs my shoulder and he looks me in the eyes and he goes, Isaac, how come it took you so long to come? And I say, oh, I don't know, college, I got this, that. You know, I've been emailing a bunch. You guys are on Gmail, I don't know if you know that. And he looks at me and he goes, why didn't you Facebook me? And it's just, I was not on Facebook, and he had been on Facebook the entire, I could have direct messaged him or whatever it is. So yeah, that was my time in Bhutan.